Who's that?
Constantine. So, like, yeah. Expect him to get it wrong.
Did you go over Constantine's conversion?
What's that?
Did you go over Constantine's conversion?
Yeah, I mentioned that it's not clear that ever became a Christian. If he was baptized at all, it was probably on his deathbed.
Yeah. But yeah. Whole, like, seeing the...
Oh, there's the, yeah. Well, whether he saw that vision or that was just a story, I don't really know.
Yeah.
He showed some signs of being sincere, I think.
Yeah.
Some signs.
No, I thought so too.
But it's sort of hard to judge Constantine.
My kid, sorry. Well, I shouldn't need it, my kid.
Okay. So, here's a quote. Are we ready to go here? Here's a quote by Augustine about the Donatus. He said, "Seeing that God, by a hidden though just disposition, has predestined some to ultimate penalty of hell, it is doubtless better that an overwhelming majority of the Donatus should be collected and reabsorbed into the Catholic Church while a few perish in their own flames. Better indeed that all the Donatists should burn in the flames of hell for their sacrilegious dissension." In other words, he's saying, hey, if we massacre a few Donatists, if that's the price of rescuing the Donatism for Christianity, good, because, you know, that either they would be actually saved, in which case, if we kill them, they go to heaven. This is a Christian justifying killing. Because, hey, you know, if they're really saved, they're going to go to heaven anyway. If they aren't, what's the difference? But at least we save kind of the whole church by bringing them back in. And so he began a vicious persecution, a really vicious persecution. And there's a lot more details in my book about the councils that he called and councils that made decisions. By the way, it went both ways. Sometimes the Pope was fully behind Augustine. Sometimes the Pope was very, very strongly against Augustine in his attack on the Donatists. Yeah. In North Africa, probably him. But in Christendom in general, no, the Pope. Yeah.
So by this point, the papacy is that strong where it's we don't question Rome and all that.
Yeah. Well, Leo. I mean, Leo. Have I talked about Leo yet?
Not yet.
All right. Yeah. I haven't really. Okay. Yeah. We're getting to seriously. Yeah. So Leo, the papacy was quite strong at this point. There were periods when the papacy was quite weak. It kind of did some of these things here. All right, great. So let's talk about Pelagius. Pelagius was the arch enemy theologically of Augustine. Pelagius, we have very few actual writings of Pelagius. Most of them were burned or, you know, they were condemned or whatever. So it's a little bit hard to know what Pelagius actually taught. There's, as far as I know, there's only one major document that's believed probably to have been written by him, and that is a bunch of things that maybe he wrote. But he's been accused of Pelagianism, and since it's named after him, you might think he was a Pelagianist, but it's not clear if he was a Pelagianist or not, or whether he's just using mere rhetoric to try to get people to react or whatever. I don't really know. But here's the quote. It's in the middle of that page. It says, "Since perfection is possible for man, it is obligatory." So basically then, he taught that we could become sinless. All right? Or that we could stop sinning, if you will. Now, did he really believe that? Or was that a rhetorical point he's making? You know, I really don't know. But anyway, he believed that man has free will. And that we are not totally deprived. Oops.
I kind of like Pelagius.
It's kind of better.
Why did that happen? Oh, okay. It's not necessary. All right. So he was a Roman priest who eventually moved to the East because he was kicked out. He was anathematized in the West. So he ended up in the East, where the Eastern Church was actually fairly supportive of Pelagius. The Eastern Church believed in free will, generally. All right, anyway, he taught that we choose God and that God makes us more holy. And that's kind of the Eastern idea anyway, that we get deified, deification. So basically, we choose to respond to God's grace, and therefore we're saved. And then over time, God makes us more like him. That's that deification. That's the Eastern idea. So, therefore, he was more acceptable in the East. In fact, he fled to the East where he died later on. As far as I know, he died a natural death. Anyway, he said, since perfection is possible for man, it is obligatory, he stressed the need for holiness of individual Christians. And Augustine didn't stress that, really, hardly at all. So the monks loved Pelagius. All right, the monks obviously believed in free will, because why would you want to become a monk? Yeah. You know, people becoming a monk were choosing to become a monk. So generally, the monks were not really all that fired about Augustine. And most of the ascetics, which were mostly in the East, by the way, the number of ascetics in the western part of the church were very small, very, very small. In the East, it was huge. All right, and so generally, ascetics were supporters of Pelagius. All right, and of course, Pelagius was an ascetic, and who was trying to encourage the ascetic lifestyle. Interestingly, so did Augustine, but his theology didn't support it very well, but nevertheless. Anyway, he definitively rejected the doctrine of original sin. That much we can say very confidently. Thank you very much, Pelagius. Anyway, he died in 418. His place was taken by Julian of Ecclenum. Okay, I got the next slide. There's... Ah, yes. Remember? I knew Confessions was on a slide. There it is. This is supposedly what Pelagius looked like. I don't know if it really is. Did Pelagius teach works salvation? Well, do Baptists accuse us of teaching works salvation? Do we? Well, we say we don't. So did Pelagius teach works salvation? I would say he leaned that way more than he should have, probably. I think it's fair enough to say he probably leaned that direction to a level that we'd probably be a little bit uncomfortable with. But, you know, how about the pot calling the kettle black for Catholicism in the medieval period with works salvation? But nevertheless, in principle, Augustine was Catholic theology until the time of Thomas Aquinas, in which case, definitely not works salvation. Do not accuse Augustine of believing in works salvation. I don't care. Oh, did this thing come on and go off again, or what happened?
It hasn't
come back on
yet. Yeah,
it's... All right, that's fine. All right, so I think we are what they would call semi-Pelagians. All right? So there's Pelagianism, which is a theological position to which Pelagius himself may not have actually ascribed. So Pelagianism is essentially self-created holiness through hard work, essentially. And so Pelagianism, I suppose, is work salvation. I guess it is almost the definition of Pelagianism, but it's doubtful that Pelagius was a Pelagian in that sense. And then there was this position of semi-Pelagianism, and I think I'm probably a semi-Pelagianist. I think. I'm not sure.
Yeah, so he's more in line kind of like James talks about.
That God works with us, essentially. Yeah, something like that. So God's grace extends to that his grace works with our faith, to something like that.
In your notes here, you have Pelagius and Julian pushed Augustine to double down on double predestination.
Double predestination. Double predestination is those who go to heaven are predestined by God to go to heaven, and those who go to hell are predestined by God to go to hell. In other words, let's say 97% of all people go to hell and 3% of all people go to heaven. The reason those 97% of people go to hell is because God said, you're going to hell whether you like it or not. Okay, that's double predestination. And the thing is, the logical extension of total depravity is that. But had Augustine gone there? The answer is probably not. He became far more radical in his predestination over time. So my understanding from reading quite a bit about Augustine is that he moved quite more strongly towards sovereignty and predestination, because I'm not going to be like that. That Pelagius guy, oh man. So he whether Pelagius moved as far in that direction as he said he did, I think it's kind of doubtful, partly because he died. That Augustine went more strongly in this hard predestination, I think is pretty clear. And, you know, that's the whole pendulum swinging thing. So that's a warning to us to not behave that way. So Julian of Ecclenum was another scholar who kind of carried on the Pelagian idea. He was actually in the West, so he got in big trouble. It's lucky he wasn't killed. But anyway, he accused Augustine of making God the author of evil as well as good. Okay, now we're going to start to ask a question, what is evil? That's a really good question. What is evil? Is evil a thing? Is there such a thing as evil apart from people doing evil things? What is the nature of evil? But Julian said, if Augustine is right, then God is the author not of only of good, but of evil. All right, and you know, it's pretty hard to deny that that's implied in what's going on here. All right, so anyway, so like it says, you already quoted me from the bottom of that page about where Julian and Pelagius seem to have moved Augustine in that. So let's talk about our doctrine of salvation, which is our soteriology. I'm quoting Athanasius here. Athanasius was actually, you can see that, mid 4th century. He's even pre Augustine, but he talked about our being transformed into the likeness of God. That's that deification, that Eastern idea. And so in the East, they generally taught that our salvation is because of the incarnation of Jesus. And in the West, they generally taught that our salvation is because of the death of Jesus. Okay? Now, which would we find ourselves agreeing with more? We would agree with the West. And I think probably the West was probably, you can probably find a lot more scriptures to defend that idea. But the idea of the effect of the incarnation is something at least to be allow yourself to be affected by. Think about the incarnation more. As you read the Eastern Fathers, you will tend to be in that way. Let me see. Over time, the East emphasized the incarnation as the chief means of salvation. God becoming flesh allows us who are of the flesh to come to God. Okay, so Him coming down in the form of flesh provided a bridge so that we could become more like God. And, you know, I think of scriptures like 2 Corinthians 3:18, which says we are being transformed with ever-increasing glory. And the idea that the incarnation, God coming in the flesh, is a means by which we become more like God, even after our salvation. And, you know, salvation is an event, but it's also a process. Now, of course, we would tend to think of it principally as an event. And maybe even that's true. Maybe it is mostly an event and only much less a process. I'll tell you this right now. The East would see it mostly as a process and hardly an event at all. The West at that time would see it as an event, you know, not a process. All right, but I think the truth may combine those things. The Western view of salvation focused in on the crucifixion, which, of course, Greg did as well yesterday, and I thought that was brilliant. But we're saved by God's death on the cross rather than by God becoming flesh. All right. But again, in Hebrews, he talks about he became a perfect priest, all right, because of his incarnation. So I think there's something from the East to be learned there. And also, the Bible talks about our present salvation. All right, let's read 1 Peter 2:2. So you see what I'm talking about there. I think we see both of these aspects, the Eastern and the Western idea. I think we see both of them biblical on some level, and you have to kind of study these things out, think about them, find out how much truth there is in the one and how much in the other, or reject totally one of them if you want. All right. 1 Peter 2, verse 1 and 2. Therefore, rid yourself of all malice and deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and slander of every kind. Like newborn babies, crave pure spiritual milk, so by it you may grow up in your salvation. And in fact, let's go ahead and read the 2 Corinthians 3:18 passage. I'm reading ones that support the opposite of what we're used to thinking, mainly because you don't need to read those other passages about, you know, Acts 2:38. I don't think we really spend a lot of time there. Right, 2 Corinthians 3:18, which I think is an awesome passage. Of course, they're all awesome, but this is a super duper awesome one. All right, it says here, and we all who with unveiled faces contemplate the Lord's glory are being transformed into his image. There's deification right there. And that is the principal Eastern Orthodox concept of salvation even today. I don't think it's illegitimate. You have to understand the West looks at legal transactional kinds of things. The East tends to look more at relational kinds of things. I think there's truth in both. So the East looked at the incarnation. The West looked at the crucifixion. What neither talked about is the resurrection. And I really, really loved Greg's treatment of death, burial, and resurrection. I think that's a beautiful thing to think about. Even Greg would say, hey, it's not the final story. It's just it's another way to think about it. I think it's a pretty good way to think about it. I think it's more healthy than either of these pictures that we have from these old times. All right, oh, Acts 2:41, he says, save yourselves from what? From your sins? No, from this corrupt generation. All right, Ambrose. All right, do I have a slide about Ambrose? I can't remember. All right, here, I'm getting behind already. The East, God becoming flesh, allows us to become like God, stresses deification. The West, Jesus being crucified as a substitutory sacrifice for our sins, which is the main way we've been taught to think about it. And salvation is in the future. All right, in other words, you know, when Jesus comes back. And I'm giving you a couple. Oh! It's still overheated. How could it still be overheated?
I don't know. It's been blinking.
All right. I have my own projector, if it comes down to it. Where did I put my projector? Let's not stop class, but let's consider possibly turning this on. If you can get it going by playing with it, but you probably should pay attention to class instead. So we may turn that on. Later on. Okay. Well, I'm using my PowerPoint, even though you're not seeing it, because it's helping me to stay focused. All right. Late church fathers, the next slide says. Ambrose and Jerome. Ambrose and Jerome are not a huge, huge, huge thing to be aware of, but I think there are people to be aware of on some level. Ambrose was a typical Western Christian, so his principal concerns were organization of the church, bureaucracy in the church, the hierarchy of the church, salvation being found in the church. He wrote, his most famous work was On the Sacraments. All right, there you go. So talk about him influencing Augustine about sacraments. His principal famous work was called On the Sacraments. He's best known as a brilliant preacher. Well, we don't have too many recordings of his sermons, but we'll just have to assume this guy could really preach. He could really preach up a storm. And his preaching was both inspirational and deep. And that seems like a really good model for us, although we can't really exactly model him because we don't have any of his sermons. But all right. An interesting story here is Ambrose was a politician, but a good sort of politician. A good politician is somebody who brings people together, unlike the president we have right now. But anyway, by the way, let's give a little bit of honor to the first George Bush, who really did that. You know, he was an honorable president who actually had moral conviction, unlike certain presidents. So, and I guess he died yesterday, so it's worth honorable man. Whether you voted for him or not, you probably weren't even able to vote. Whether you voted for him or not, you had to believe he really was a public servant. He truly was, not out to destroy everything we care about, like certain presidents. Anyway, get away from politics right away. All right. Anyway, so there was a big dispute between the Arians and the Nicene people. And Arianism was big because the Goths came in, and the, I believe it was the Ostrogoths who came into Italy, all right, and later on the Lombards. And these groups were Arian. They had an Arian theology. They had an Arian creed. There's a creed the Goths used. Oh, did it come on? Brilliant. Well, we'll see. Fantastic. Anyway, so he worked out a compromise where everybody was happy. That's a good thing. All right, and so the bishop died, and there was an assembly, and basically, by acclamation, they said, Ambrose should be our bishop. There's one problem. He hadn't been baptized yet. So the dude wasn't even a Christian. All right, now doesn't the Bible say something about a bishop should not be a recent convert? How about having a guy being the bishop of Milan who was baptized, like, say, a week before or something like that? But that's what happened. So the little qualification issue was taken care of. Within a week, he got baptized into his bishop. All right, but all the indication is that he was a wonderful bishop. Now, okay, sure, sacraments and all that, but I'm trying to judge the person's character. Right? You know, I admit there's some really crazy doctrine out there, but he was seemed to be somebody, a uniter, not a divider, a brilliant preacher. He did baptize Augustine. Now you could say that's the worst thing that ever happened, I guess, but I think it's good. Hope the guy goes to heaven. Also, he was one of the earliest bishops to, like, in-your-face confront Roman emperors. This was a dangerous thing, you can imagine. All right, and because church and state was not married yet. That came after Augustine. That's what Augustine proposed, and that's what eventually happened, especially in the West. So Justina, who was the wife, actually the mother of the emperor, he had a confrontation, and he refused to back down. And basically, Valentinian said, all right, Ambrose gets to pick this kind of thing. He even had a direct confrontation with Theodosian. This is not even in our notes, but Theodosian is the first one who said paganism is illegal. That Christianity is the official religion of Rome. I believe it was 395, right at this time, almost exactly when this is happening. He was the one in 395 who said, officially, Christianity is the only religion of Rome. And soon after that, they basically outlawed paganism altogether and closed down all the pagan schools. But anyway, so Theodosian, Theodosian was a Nicene, not Arian, which is fairly important. But Theodosian had overseen a massacre of Christians. And basically, Ambrose says, you need to repent. You need to confess your sin. You need to come and essentially do penance before me. Wow, that's doing that to the emperor? Imagine doing that to certain people who don't know how to repent. Oh, never mind. Let's get away from politics here, who don't believe they ever did anything wrong. Whoops. All right. Anyway, so you're giving up on that thing. Okay, good.
It's overheated, probably.
But how can it be overheated after 20 minutes?
I don't know.
So I think it's overheating rather than being overheated. I think it's overheating. All right, so we're going to go for that one there.
Yeah, where's the...
So you put it in HDMI 1.
Okay.
Yeah, so it'll take a while. You probably have to do that. Yeah. It'll take right there, right where you're touching. All right, great. So one of the earliest arguments for transubstantiation, here it is. But if the blessing of a man, and he's using what Elisha did, all right, but the blessing of a man had such power as to change nature, right? Because Elisha made the oil to be bottomless and all that kind of stuff. He said, had such power as to change nature, what are we to say that the divine consecration, where the very words of the Lord and Savior operate? For that sacrament which you receive is made what it is by the word of Christ. In other words, what he's saying here is, when they go hubbly bubbly, whatever they say, you know, the mass thing that they do, I'm being a little bit too negative there, I apologize, that somehow it transforms into the actual blood and and flesh of Jesus. Never mind that it doesn't look like the blood and flesh of Jesus, but it is anyway. It's a sort of mystical how that happens. Okay, I say it probably doesn't happen at all, but who am I to say that? I guess, you know, what can I say? All right, anyway, Jerome. Jerome is, his principal importance to us is that he created the accepted translation of the entire Bible that was used for, still used today, of course, but it was the principal Bible of the Western Church, the Vulgate. Vulgate does not mean vulgar. Vulgate means common. In other words, it was the Bible used by common people. Probably Jerome was the greatest scholar of his age. Oh, thank you. It's doing it again. Yeah, it's going to do it two or three times. I should.
The display settings so it could be a larger.
Yeah. Thank you. I don't know why that happened. No. Maybe if I end it and let me see. View. I think maybe under view, possibly. No. Fit to window, maybe? No.
Go back to slideshow.
Yeah.
Oh, there.
Oh, good. Mine's still showing what you were seeing, but that's good. I get to see the next one. Okay, good. All right, anyway, so he published the Vulgate translation, which doesn't affect us a whole lot. We don't read the Vulgate. We don't read the Bible in Latin. But it was a brilliant translation, and he was maybe the greatest Hebrew scholar in the church at that time. By the way, Augustine virtually didn't even know Greek. Virtually didn't even know it. Jerome was, perfect in Latin, perfect in Greek, and perfect in Hebrew. Jerome was an amazing scholar. Augustine was no slouch at scholarship, but he wouldn't hold a candle, I would say, probably to Jerome, the greatest scholar of his age. Jerome was a bit of a curmudgeon. He's been described as bitter, vindictive, vain, and inconsistent. Well, how'd you like to have that as a description of you as a disciple, all right? Bitter, vindictive, vain, and inconsistent. Ouch. A great scholar, and he produced the most important translation of the Bible ever, other than maybe the King James translation and maybe the Septuagint. By the way, he was the one who included the Apocrypha in the Catholic Bible, but he did it over his dead body, not literally. He was vehemently against inclusion of the Apocrypha. Why? Because the Apocrypha wasn't in Hebrew. He believed it had never even been in Hebrew. That the Apocrypha was either Aramaic or Greek, and therefore were not ancient documents, certainly were not canonized by the Jews. He vehemently opposed the inclusion of the Apocrypha, but he was basically ordered, virtually, to include a translation of those texts into Latin as well. Tobit, Judith, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, Wisdom of Sirach, documents. So they became part of the Roman Catholic Bible. There were other Latin translations, by the way. There were many Latin translations. None of them were nearly the quality of the Vulgate. So the Vulgate became the official Bible of the West for forever, right up into modern times. Okay? He lived the life of an ascetic. That's all I have to say about Jerome. Nice guy, but so I want to talk a little bit about asceticism in the West. At this time, priests were not required to be celibate. In fact, you have regular clergy and secular clergy. Regular clergy were raised up in these church schools. The secular clergy were basically the local clergy. Oh, yeah. Sorry, that's an interesting picture there. But that is what this guy, Simeon Stylites, was into doing, getting up on columns and stuff like that. But anyway, so obviously the monks were celibate. Priests were not generally celibate. In fact, a lot of priests weren't celibate, but celibacy was still sort of celebrated as the ideal for a priest. All right, venerations. We're talking about. I'm describing the church in roughly 400 AD. Yeah.
Does that thinking come from Paul? The whole idea of like, would it be better for you to be single than not?
No, I think it comes from the whole spirit of asceticism, which finds its way into every religious movement. It comes from, Augustine obviously supported it, but it's long before that. And it's partly the result of the situation, because the bottom line is men and women came to the conclusion that in order to live a holy life, I need to live it outside of the church rather than in the church, because the church was so corrupt. There was so much immorality in the church. So it's sort of like us looking at this group here. I can't worship with them. I have to go to a church of just disciples. I mean, the spirit of I just want to be with disciples, you could say that's kind of sort of in a way, in a sort of bizarre and weird way, kind of what's going on here. All right. So they wanted to live truly holy and righteous lives. They felt that was not possible within the church. But then again, they celebrated the kind of from the Neoplatonist idea of the physical being bad and evil. It's kind of a mixture of things. All right, so venerations of saints was common at this point. We began to have church calendars in the 5th century with saints' days. Like I said, the next time somebody tells you that they were in the catacombs hiding away from persecution, that may have happened at one time, but that is not the reason Christians were in the catacombs. They're in the catacombs because they were the cult of the martyrs. They were there to not worship the martyrs, but to venerate them. Even today, despite what all appearances, Catholics do not worship Mary. Well, okay, they do, but they don't officially worship Mary. Not officially. All right, here's Pope Gregory, which I'm getting ahead of myself here. Pope Gregory said, the temples of the idols should not be destroyed, but altars constructed and relics deposited. Now, this is an expedient, if you will. The Catholic Church said, rather than destroy paganism, we're going to Christianize paganism. And that was the policy of the Catholic Church, particularly supported by Gregory. And when I do that, I'm kind of getting out of order here. All right. So he said, and since they are wont to kill many oxen and sacrifice to demons, they should also have some solemnity of this kind in a changed form. On the anniversaries of the holy martyrs, whose relics are deposited there, for it is undoubtedly impossible to cut away everything at once from hard hearts, since one who strives to ascend to the highest place must needs rise by steps or paces and not by leaps. But that's the assumption that you don't have to be a disciple of Jesus to be a Christian. So if we absorb the world into the church, guess what we're doing? We're absorbing the world into the church. And he said, there's two ways to Christianize people. One is by asking them to be Christians, or by kind of having a compromise, a little bit pagan, a little bit Christian, and we'll move them in the right direction over time. All right, that's a nice thought, I guess, but I don't think it's a biblical way of approaching things. So anyway, the famous ascetics, the first great famous ascetic is this guy Anthony, who went into the desert in Egypt. He lived to be something like 103 years old. It's crazy how long this guy lived. He was a hermit. I think it'd be fair to say all the early ascetics were hermits. The word hermit means desert. It's a hermitage is a place in the desert, essentially. All right. It's sort of tilted. If it doesn't bother you, it doesn't bother me. This room is tilted, by the way. I don't know if you noticed that. The room is tilted. It's kind of... Wow, what's going on there? The room is tilted. That's not your funny vision going on in your eyes. And so basically, hermits would go out into the desert. They'd live in a cave, and people would bring them food. They would be nude or semi-nude, eating very little food, sleeping on a rock, just barely keeping themselves alive, very, very thin. All right. The first of the Cenobites, that's a big word, Cenobites or whatever, this guy Pacimonious, this is around 300 AD, maybe very, very late 200s. They said, because the bottom line is these guys are out doing their own thing, totally doing their own thing. Bishops don't like that. Bishops like to control everybody. All right, so in order to protect the ascetic movement, they decided to form these communes, if you will, or orders. And the first one that had to define order was this guy Pacomonius. And so they had loose confederations. They weren't quite what we think today of a monastery where there's this head guy and everybody's doing exactly what this head guy said. It's kind of like a commune where they kind of sort of work together as opposed to working completely separately. Okay, got it. Sorry about that. I skipped one thing on the next page. This wonderful quote by Cyril of Jerusalem, all right, which I didn't read, and I started talking about ascetics, but I got to read this quote. This is great. Cyril of Jerusalem, same time frame as Ambrose of Milan, right? And he said, "For as the bread and wine of the Eucharist before the invocation of the Holy and Adorable Trinity were simple bread and wine, well, after the invocation, the bread becomes the body of Christ and the wine the blood of Christ." Look at that word, invocation. That's what witches do, you know? An invocation. They pronounce an invocation. Like I said, hocus pocus, boom. This was the idea. So when I said that Augustine did not invent transubstantiation, that's certainly true. But he did strongly support it. All right, great. So we have Pacomonius in the 4th century. Basil, I've already mentioned Basil. Basil was one of the Cappadocian fathers. And he was, all these Cappadocian fathers were very, very strong supporters of asceticism and monks. They believed the highest ideal of a bishop should be somebody who'd been a monk. They would have argued that unless you are a monk, you probably shouldn't even be a bishop. Which, you know, monks are pretty committed, you know, they're fairly committed. So I believe if monks were the only people who became bishops, I believe the church would have been better off than if it weren't. Unfortunately, many bishops were very worldly people. Most of them, though, actually were fairly sincere at this time. So, like it says here, ascetics began to have more influence over common people, even than the bishops, because people said, look at the bishops' lives, look at the monks' lives. And so it was very, very common for masses of people to go out into the desert to hear sermons by these monks. And like the bishops, yeah, whatever, you know. I might be exaggerating a little bit, but this definitely was going on. All right, the monks generally were against a lot of the things being taught by Augustine, specifically predestination, because it decreased the motivation for people to live the holy life. Sure. All right, and which kind of Calvinism? Why bother to go out of your way to repent when God's going to force you to repent whether you want to or not? Well, our Baptist friends would say, well, look how awesome a life we're living. And that'd be true. But I think some of the motivation for righteous living, if we have nothing to do with it one way or another, logically, that would reduce the level of feeling like we really need to do something about this. So generally, the monks were not really too excited about this. But nevertheless, another thing is that the monks were very independent. And they were, it was kind of like the church, there was the papacy, the bishops, and the monks. And so at Chalcedon, the monks shut that all down. And they said, you cannot be a monk. You have to be under the local bishop. So after Chalcedon, every single monk, if they were not submitting to a local bishop who might not even agree with the ascetic lifestyle, then they were excommunicated. So you got the monks over here, the bishops over here. After Chalcedon, it's like this. And so the hierarchy of the church is totally over the ascetic movements. Good or bad, you decide. You probably reject the whole idea. Maybe that's so. During the 4th and 5th century, a lot of monks, it became like a show. It's like a one-upsmanship. And it's like competing each other for how horribly to beat your body. And it's kind of like the more radical and ridiculous you were, the bigger the following you'd get. And a really common thing is to get up on a column. So this is not a joke. So they tried for kind of like the Guinness Book of World Records, who could sit up on top of a column the longest. and they'd raise up food on a rope and not talk to anybody. It's like, this is their idea of discipleship. All right? This was largely in Syria. What became the Church of the East? I'll talk about that more. The Church of the East was especially prone to these kind of crazy, whacked out, I'm holier than you are because I stay in the cave farther away and I eat less food and I have less clothing and I talk to people less and these kinds of things. It seems bizarre, but that was worshipped as if that makes you closer to God, which I don't believe that it does. John Cassius mentioned his name. He's the one who started Cenobite monasticism in the West. John Cassian, do I have dates? Yeah, 365 to 433. So it's not really till the early 5th century that you begin to see monks in the West. Almost all of them were in the East up to this time. Rome is more into practical Christianity. Next slide here. Okay. Now, let's categorize the branches of Christianity at 500 AD. This is after Chalcedon. After Chalcedon, Monophysitism was definitely condemned, and Nestorianism was definitely condemned. It didn't end Monophysitism, not at all. All right, that's Alexandria. It didn't end Nestorianism, that's Antioch. They just went elsewhere. So these are the major branches. You've got Western Christendom. Now, Western Christendom and Eastern Christendom officially are still unified at this point. The Great Division happened in 1054, which is 500 years later. But I'm telling you, they might just as well have been two different churches. They might just as well. All right? Rome, as I've been saying repeatedly, represents legal questions and they're very, very hierarchical. Their language is Latin. Their salvation thing has to do with the crucifixion, these kind of things. Eastern Christendom, centered in Byzantium or Constantinople, with the patriarch over Eastern Christianity. They had a far more spiritual kind of Christianity, a Christianity more based on experience rather than sacrament, although they did have the sacraments, more mystical, and Greek. Then you have the Coptic Church. The language of the Coptic Church was Coptic. All right? And their headquarters was in Alexandria, and later Cairo, but Alexandria. They were monophysite, which means one what? One nature. So they wouldn't deny that Jesus was human, but they'd say that his humanness was totally swallowed up by his deity. So they minimized his humanness to the point where it virtually didn't exist. All right, the one nature school in Alexandria focused on the divine nature of Jesus, minimizes humanity, and they were the ones who invented Theotokos, and they took Theotokos to a large extent. All right, now there's what's known as the Church of the East. Now, arguably, the Church of the East is both Nestorian and Jacobite. All right, so in the East, you have these two churches. There was no Christendom. There was no Christian state. In fact, in the East, the accepted religion was Zoroastrianism. You might have heard of Zoroastrianism. This was the dualistic religion of Persia. All right, the language of the Church of the East was primarily Syrian. You've heard of different translations of the Bible. You hear it translated into Syriac. One of the very, very earliest translations of the Greek New Testament was into Coptic and Latin and Syriac. So the four languages of Christianity were Greek, Latin, Coptic, and Syriac. In Syriac was the language of the Church of the East. Now, one of the problems with both Nestorianism and the Jacobite churches is that the accepted languages where they went were not Syriac. So they, unlike the Copts, where the Coptic church, the language of the church was the language of the people where the church was, in the East, the church had its own language, kind of like what I described in Central Asia in our sister churches today, where the language at church is Russian, but the majority of people there don't speak Russian, which is a problem, don't you think? That's a problem for growing the church there, yes? All right, so anyway, so you have Nestorianism, which highly emphasized the humanity of Jesus, yes? and treated Jesus as if he was too sort of, he's kind of schizophrenic almost. All right. The two wills are not necessarily in agreeing with each other. That's diophthalatism, which we'll talk about later. Antiochian school, etc. Christotokos. And then you have really two monophysite churches. One monophysite church had Syrian as its language. That was the one that spread through Iraq, through Iran, into Afghanistan, into Pakistan, into India, and even into China. That's the monophysite church of the East. And you have the diophysite church of the East, which is the Nestorian church. These two theologies are opposed to each other. There were many diophysites in the West, but they essentially left. They either converted to Chalcedonian Christianity, or they would go to the East. Okay, so those are the five churches. Now you're probably aware that Rome fell. You heard about that, right? And this is what brought on the medieval period. Essentially, is the fall of Rome. The Huns, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the Vandals, all these other peoples. It destroyed Western Rome, but it did not destroy Eastern Rome. So Eastern Rome, here we go. Eastern Rome was roughly this, okay, which included southern Italy, by the way. So here's Byzantium, which remained as a power, but this part just fell apart. And the church became very chaotic. Churches were abandoned. There are whole areas which became non-Christian. In fact, England became non-Christian. In the 6th, 7th century, England was a pagan place. It had been a fairly Christianized place. And large parts of Gaul and Germany basically abandoned Christianity almost completely. And in fact, it appeared for a time that the West may become pagan altogether. The church was doing very, very poorly. All during that time, the Church of the East was growing, was gaining converts. I think I might have a map here. Yes, so here's a picture showing the spread of Christianity to the East. So while the West was in chaos, while the churches were being abandoned, while the universities were closing, the population of Rome went from nearly a million down to about 50,000, later down to only 10,000. Okay, in the West, political anarchy and chaos. In the East, there were universities, there were Christian schools, there were massive monasteries, and some of the greatest centers of Christianity were in the Sibbets. You can't, it's not focused enough. Can it be focused a little bit? It's probably not enough to read it anyway. But that's better. In the Sibbets, Baghdad, these were Christian cities. All right, where huge churches, monasteries, even though politically it was Persian, it was under the Sassanid Empire, the official religion of the empire was Zoroastrianism, but the Zoroastrians said, y'all come, because who was the enemies of the Sassanid Empire? Byzantium. So basically the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So believe it or not, might be surprising to you, but the Zoroastrians said, y'all come on, yes, come on in. And so although it was never the adopted religion, and although they tended to not blend, they became kind of like the wealthy class, the trading class, and because they're the wealthy and trading class, they ended up in India. There was a definite Indian presence by the 5th century, all right? Also in southern Arabia. Here, by the way, is going to explain why Muhammad at least had some exposure to Christianity. It was probably a fairly corrupt kind of Christianity, but nevertheless, there was some exposure to Christianity. So that's the Church of the East. All right. Okay. East of Christianity, all that, I've talked about all that. Another person I mentioned, I'm on page 37. It starts with Ulfilas. By this time, the primary people spreading Christianity were monks. All right, it was not bishops, it was not priests, it was generally monks. Ulfilas converted the Goths. Let's go back to where are the Goths. The Goths are here. There's the Goths. the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths. The bottom line is Christianity in Spain became Arian. Christianity in Gaul became not completely Arian, but largely Arian. Christianity in northern Italy was mainly Arian. Whoa! All right, so the Christianity that kind of conquered Rome and all these, in quotes, barbarians came in, they were primarily not of the Chalcedonian Creed, but of the Arian faith, if you will. Okay, let me see. You got your Goths, your Visigoths. This guy Ulfilas converted the Goths and created a Gothic script. They had no written language, and a Gothic creed, which said that there's a time when Jesus was not divine, that kind of thing. Also worth mentioning, there's a whole section on Patrick. He's Patrick, Saint Patrick, whatever. He went to Ireland. He went to Ireland in the early 5th century. An amazing man. His life is, they got to make a movie out of this amazing life. He was taken there as a slave, essentially. And he converted, he and his successors practically converted all of Ireland. I think I'm going to mention him later in my notes. Let me skip down. Okay, now we're in the West. Near the bottom of the page, we have the Goths, the Visigoths, the Vandals, the Huns. Devastated the empire, chaos rules, whole areas, whole massive areas were completely de-Christianized, completely returned to paganism. Okay. But near the end of the 6th century, Spain reverted to Chalcedonianism, which that's a good thing. As sort of seemed unimportant at the time, 589 is when they started in the Council of Toledo, they had it and the sun. All right, so in the Nicene Creed, the one that was published at Constantinople, it said he proceeds from the Father. And they said, no, he proceeds from the Father and the Son. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to raise the divinity of Jesus. Why? Because they just got rid of Arianism. And so how are we going to get rid of Arianism? We're going to make Jesus even more divine. We're going to raise his level of divinity here. Jesus did say, I'm going to go and the Father's going to send the Holy Spirit. So who sent the Holy Spirit? Was it him or the Father? I don't care. I couldn't care less about that. Who cares? Well, I'll tell you right, they cared. I'll tell you right now. So this was one of those moments in history which had huge implications, because when they added Filioque, in other words, he precedes the Father and the Son. That was the straw that broke the camel's back that split the Eastern and Western Church in the Great Schism in 1054. So that's, to us, who cares? I don't care the slightest bit about that, but I'm telling you, people back then cared about it a lot. Okay, I want to mention a little bit about Leo. Do I have slides about Leo? All right, I'll mention Leo. Leo is the first person that you could probably say, now that dude, he was a pope. So when did the papacy begin? Well, when did the Catholic Church begin? When did the papacy begin? I'll say this. Leo claimed to be more or less what modern popes would claim to be. He didn't claim to speak ex cathedra, but, comes pretty close. And by the way, Leo was the chief person responsible for the Chalcedonian decision. In my book, I go into that quite a bit. And Leo was, he wasn't an all bad guy, you know what I'm saying? And he reached a very wise compromise. The West could help people to compromise because they weren't so worried about all this theological stuff anyway. Hey, whatever makes everybody, work together, we're good at that. In fact, Rome went back and forth between Alexander, Antioch. They're just back and forth. And whether Rome was currently a friend of Alexander or Antioch kind of determined the decisions at all these church councils. So anyway, Leo oversaw, he wrote what's called the Tome of Leo, which essentially was a rough draft for the decision at Chalcedon. He's basically, the argument for Rome was this. One thing about Rome is they never had all this stuff going on. You know, Rome had never had a heretical bishop. I mean, Antioch had had people who were total heretics. Alexander, Constantinople, the history was very colorful. But the one church that had always been Orthodox, was Rome. So Rome had the longest succession of bishops other than Jerusalem, number one. And it was the place where Orthodoxy had been maintained with an unbroken line. So the one church that everybody trusted was Rome. So Rome took precedence, and all the other bishops, it's kind of like they had the five patriarchies, which is Jerusalem, Alexandria, Antioch, Constantinople, and Rome. And the five patriarchates all said, Rome is the chief of the patriarchs, essentially. The chief amongst equals. Well, later on, it wasn't the chief amongst equals, it's the chief amongst a bunch of people who are not equal at all. So, so Leo is one of the first to argue, no, not chief amongst equals, chief. That everybody has to submit to Rome. All right? Leo said, this is a great quote, to us, in other words, the bishops of Rome, is committed the common care of who? Of all. And no single bishop's administration is other than a part of our task. Concerning his decrees, he is speaking whose representative we are. And by we, he meant me. That's that royal we. So basically saying, just you know, everybody, all Christians here, just you know, I am God's spokesman, and if I say God said it, that means God said it. So that kind of sounds pretty much like infallibility of the Pope. They technically did not claim infallibility. They technically did not claim to speak ex cathedra, but for all practical purposes, they did. I'm not sure we could say that Leo's the first one to say this, but Leo's the first one to say this and basically to impose it. Does that mean everybody said yes, sir? No, it doesn't mean that. But it means that at least in the West, they said exactly. Exactly. And so he certainly was the head of the Western Church, which, of course, what the popes still are today. Now let's talk about Gregory. Gregory the Great. And he was pretty great. Even Calvin said he was the last good pope. All right? And, you know, I find it hard to hate Augustine. You know, I'm sorry. I can't help. What can I say? I'm just teasing you. But you know, Gregory was everything Augustine was, and worse if you want to say that. But Gregory is a very attractive person. The guy, he just loved Jesus. He loved the poor people. He made the Latin Church the protector of the poor and the impoverished, and it's a beautiful thing. All right? He was the first pope to have formerly been a monk. The first one. Again, in the West, they favored administrators as popes. Right? That's kind of the whole Western thing. And he made the Western Church very spiritual. All right? And arguably, he saved the West from the Arian Christianity. Why? Because, man, Rome was, it was kind of awesome. All right, Gregory to me is a fairly attractive figure. Okay, got it. It's not bothering you that it's tilted, but it's bothering me that it's tilted. Okay, he was the greatest scholar of his age, but that's not saying much because by the 7th century, how much scholarship was even going on? Or by the late 6th century, early 7th century. I mean, all the universities were closed. There were still a few schools in Italy. Outside of Italy, nothing. Of course, in the East, there were schools, but not in the West. So, but he was the greatest scholar of his age, and he's one of the, in quotes, doctors of the Western Church, along with Augustine and Thomas Aquinas. He made a Rome a model for caring for the poor and the sick. And, I mean, if you read some of the quotes from Gregory, I mean, we have to take care of the poor. We have to take care of the widows and the orphans. And he was a great spokesperson for that. He was the first pope to actually rule over territory. But, you know, the reason he ruled over territory, what it was is, this was a time, you have to understand, West fell apart, right? And so you have this chaos. You have the Goths, the Visigoths, and all this warfare going on. In the East, you've got the Byzantine Empire. But the Byzantine Empire was going through plague, and there's no food. Famine, thank you. So the bottom line is, Rome was left to its own devices. Officially, Byzantium was over Italy, officially. In fact, Byzantium even controlled significant territory in Italy. So the Pope, because this is when the feudal system was starting, the Pope, as far as the feudal system goes, was under the emperor in Byzantium. Of course, spiritually, he said it's the reverse. But the bottom line is, Italy is like, it's your problem. And so so Gregory set up this huge system of taking care of the poor and the needy throughout Italy. And eventually people said, here, just take our territory. He was virtually given the original apostolic see. Not S-E-A, S-E-E, right? The papal states. So the Pope had temporal, that's a big word, temporal. Not just he ruled over territory. Right, he had temporal power. I don't know. What did Jesus say about his kingdom? My kingdom is not of this world and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, this is one of the worst things that ever happened to the papacy, right? I mean, the stuff that happened because the popes ruled over these states in Italy, OMG, right? But I'm telling you, when it happened at first, it was really primarily because Gregory just loved poor people. And he was a very benevolent, caring, awesome ruler. So people said, can we be under you? It kind of went like that. But you know where it went over time. Also, Gregory is the one who made Mary Magdalene into a prostitute. He said Mary Magdalene was a woman of ill repute. That's really bad.
Where did he get that from?
He made it up. He said Mary of Bethany was Mary Magdalene. And I'm telling you, this is not a good thing. They were saying women are the source of all sin, and women are just inherently weak and sinful and should not be involved in leading the church in any way whatsoever. It was a very paternalistic, it's terrible. I mean, this is a despicable thing. What he did to Mary Magdalene is, in my opinion, despicable. It makes me angry. Yeah, I agree.
It really goes to show that he's just defending his mom and he's not standing for,
Yeah. So that's a very sad moment in the history of Western Christianity when essentially this righteous woman, powerful righteous woman who was an ally of Jesus, which I guess they still agreed she was, but basically she was a woman of ill repute, which she never was. By the way, I was in Magdala about 4 weeks ago. At the synagogue there. That's where she came from. So that's not a good thing. All right. Also, Gregory, I don't know if Gregory was superstitious, but he kind of, this whole acceptance of superstition. Remember, I quoted from him a few minutes ago, right? He's the one who said, hey, look, let's turn their altars into altars. Let's turn their temples into temples. Let's not make them change too much. Let's make Christianity kind of have, you know, sacrifices. They have sacrifices. Let's have sacrifices. They have holy days. Let's have holy days. Because, you know, we don't want to, you know, and if they have the pagan gods, we're going to put the martyrs. So we'll have the saints. So no more of these pagan gods. We'll have the saints. And they're kind of like gods. Not exactly gods. But if they think of them as gods, as long as they become Christians, that's okay. Gregory was a strong supporter of that thinking. It's not so good. I just said I like the guy. Well, okay, you know. What can I say? So he did much to move the medieval church toward superstition. And superstition, I mean, the medieval church was so superstitious, it is an absolute, utter, complete embarrassment. You know, the relics, and the belief in these bogus miracles and stuff. Oh my goodness. But the thing is, belief in the relics and belief in this magical stuff was how Christianity was spread. It's just how it was spread. If you look at these guys who were still spreading Christianity into Germany and Central Europe, a lot of it was based on superstitious beliefs. They'd go in and say, you know, my God can do better magic than your God, and this kind of stuff. So that's interesting. It's not really encouraging, but it's true. Okay, great. So the Pope gains temporal power, purgatory. Now, as far as I know, Gregory was the first pope to teach this idea of purgatory. So let's see. Let's do a little quiz here. What is purgatory?
The waiting room.
Is it the same as limbo? Who goes to limbo? Limbo was invented later, I think around 12th century, 11th century. Does anybody know who goes to limbo? Yeah, babies who were not baptized go to limbo. So what's going to be your doctrine if you believe in original sin and if in baptism? What's your doctrine about a three-month-old baby who dies of plague? Going to hell, you know. Better get him baptized right away. Otherwise, they go, well, all right, we'll have limbo then. So what happens in limbo? I don't know. They're kind of in limbo, so I don't know. But anyway, purgatory. So remember, what does baptism take care of as early as, say, the 3rd or 4th century? Original sin, right? So what about sins committed afterward? Well, then you have to do penance. Well, what if you didn't do sufficient penance? Then you go to purgatory. Purge. So purgatory is where you're forgiven of those sins that you hadn't been, since baptism, that you hadn't been forgiven of before you died. Okay? And this, by the way, purgatory was not a huge thing in the 7th century and 8th century. It really wasn't. It was there. It was being taught. It's in the 11th and 12th century that purgatory dominated. It became the dominant thing about all of Christianity. Yes?
Does purgatory come from kind of similar to what Gregory was already doing? Hey, this is kind of one of those beliefs that the pagans kind of have, so it's kind of adapted to us? Or is it totally from...
It might be. My study of it, it comes from what do we do about penance? Okay, because if you have mortal sins, if you have venial sins, and because they started doing this penance, and you know, you could think, if you wanted to be cynical, you'd think of a way of the priests of manipulating people. Because I'm telling you, this became a source of huge manipulation. The doctrine of purgatory became the chief source of funds for the church. Because you could buy your way out of it. All right? But we're getting ahead of ourselves because purgatory was not a huge factor in the 7th century. It really wasn't. It was being taught, and I'm sure it was influencing people's thoughts in some ways, but it was about 300 or 400 years later that purgatory just blossomed into the main factor in Roman Christianity, which it is not today, but it was then. Yes?
It's a temporary hell holding place until you redeem post...
Hell, I don't know, but holding place? It's not completely unlike the idea of the true thing, which is, where do we go when we die?
Paradise.
We go to paradise, or Hades, if you will. So it's... But it's... Hades is a biblical teaching. Purgatory is not a biblical teaching. Not at all. All right?
It's... Like, how is it? What was the teaching, like, you didn't do this, purgatory was...
So you go to purgatory. Now, the problem is, who absolves your sins once you're in purgatory? Right. We do.
Yeah. Family members.
All right? So all these acts of indulgences and stuff, those are things you did for your relatives. Imagine the guilt involved here. Now, I don't want to spend too much time in purgatory because purgatory was not a big deal at this time. I'm just saying, there you go, just so you know, came from Gregory. All right?
Good job, Greg.
Yeah. Oh, this is a quote from Gregory. Who can doubt that it, Constantinople, is subject to the Apostolic See? Now, when he says it, he doesn't mean the Byzantium Empire. He means the Byzantine Patriarch. So he's claiming predominance over the Byzantine Patriarch. By the way, And the Council of Chalcedon officially said five equal. Guess who didn't like five equal? Oh, Leo the Great didn't like it, that's for sure. Yeah.
Where, and maybe this is more of a history question than a church history question, but where did the pride come from the Western Empire popes, especially after Rome was sacked? Like the pride to say, like, we are still, like, Rome is still the center of Christendom versus Byzantine. Like,
right.
That church wasn't experiencing the devastation that they had experienced.
Yeah, now, some of these popes probably weren't as prideful as you. It sure seems like. I mean, you know, Pope Francis, I'm the head honcho of all Christianity. I mean, imagine the you know, how incredible it is.
Yeah.
But Pope Francis probably doesn't think of himself as being a prideful person. All right, but some of the popes clearly were very proud, all right? But a lot of them thought they were defending the prerogative of the church that was rightfully belonged to the church. We'll see Anselm of Canterbury did that. But you have to understand the different political situation. In the West, the political power, it was a vacuum. And the church filled the vacuum. So in the West, the popes became politically very powerful. Not at this point, but they evolved to being very politically powerful. In the East, the Patriarch of Constantinople had no political power at all. So in the West, the Pope was over the temporal power. In the East, the temporal power was over the Patriarch completely, and the Patriarch is subservient. And then in the East, all right, in the East, there the Church had no relationship with the government at all. All right, and that's where the church was strongest. In the 8th, 9th, and 10th century, the strongest place of Christianity was not the Roman church. It was not the Byzantine church. It was the Church of the East. Okay? Yeah.
At this point, is the church the financial powerhouse that it becomes? Or?
No. No. Mm-mm. That came later. This thing here has to run its course before the church becomes a huge wealthy. Now, the church did have land, but by the late Middle Ages, the church owned as much as a third of all the land in Europe.
Yeah.
At this point, I mean, the Pope had, you know, a small territory.
Well, that was where they got their armies.
Hmm?
That was where they got their armies, was from the land ownership.
Yes.
The Crusades.
Yes. That's one of the ways. Yeah.
So would you say that because of the differences in, like, doctrine and theology between the East and the West became more about kind of control and...
Not just difference of theology, but also difference of the practical situation.
Right, so that's what led them to be more dominant.
Yes.
It seems like they're just dominant over people's lives altogether. Like, we are a nation of under God. This is how we are to lead the nation, whether you believe it or not. And then they started implementing...
Well, that was Augustine's view. Christendom was Augustine's view. And his view really happened in the West to a very, very significant extent. His idea was church and state with church over state. Right? Working in cooperation. Because the state can do what the church cannot do, which is have armies and police and go and kill people and stuff like that. So the church, the state would do that for the church. And that was the thing that pretty much happened eventually in the West. In the East, it never happened that way. So that was partly because of you know, say, an idea of Augustine, but it's partly because of the practical situation. The church had some political power in the East. It had a lot of political power in the West. And when I say the East, in the Greek world. And in the East, the church East, it had virtually none at all. Although even in the Zoroastrian Empire, Christians occupied a lot of the ministerial roles because they were the educated people, the largest.
In the East, that's because paganism was still...
Zoroastrianism, whether that's paganism... Zoroastrianism, yeah.
That was still dominant. That's why state was above church.
Right. So, in the ancient world, you got Rome, and then the Persian Empire, the Sassanids, right? The arch... power to Rome was the Persians, occupied most it sometimes Rome occupied Mesopotamia, usually it was Persia, and it occupied Persia, obviously, most of what we call Pakistan, Afghanistan, and a lot of those other stands. That was Persia, huge power with a great territory, okay, got it? And that empire, which had many, many Christians living in it, was officially Zoroastrian. Okay? Let's take a break. We went way too long, I think, on that one. So we'll have one more session before lunch, just like we did in the morning. Okay.
This might be a dumb question, but does the Catholic Church still do purgatory?
Yes, they still. Yes, absolutely. Do they still believe in indulgences? Yes. The grossness of their indulgences are not as bad, but Catholic theologians will defend indulgences. Of course they will.
I found this pretty cool.